the nation's capital. This is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. A real treat for us, ladies and gentlemen, today, John Roman. He is the senior fellow of the Urban Institute. The Urban Institute has been around since 1968. They offer an endless array of good quality research. It's one of the most respected organizations in the United States in terms of dealing with research and urban problems, specifically crime problems. John is the executive director of the D.C. Crime Policy Institute. He is also a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. One of the things we're going to discuss today is the application of crime research to cities and states. What does it mean? The fact that most cities and most states throughout the United States pretty much fly by the seat of their pants in terms of the decisions they make regarding crime policy. In the District of Columbia, what the city and what the Urban Institute is trying to do is to take a look at a wide array of research, existing research, new research, to guide city government in the District of Columbia. But it's not about D.C. The larger issue is, like I said, the title, Application of Crime Research to Cities and States. And with that long introduction, John Roman, Senior Fellow, Urban Institute, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Thanks for having me on.
John, it's been a real pleasure. You know, I've been reading your research over the course of years, and in essence, what I'm getting from all of this is that what the District of Columbia, and this lesson again applies to every other city in the country, every other state in the country, what the District of Columbia is trying to do is to take your research from the Urban Institute, one of the most respected research organizations in the country, and say to themselves, is there a way that we can use research to better do what we do, to increase public safety, to reduce our costs, to make us more efficient? Do I have it?
That's it in a nutshell.
Okay. And what does that do? What does that mean? Give me a sense as to what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis. You look at existing research. You're doing original research.
And we're doing both. So the idea is that we want to work as a partner to the local and federal agencies who operate in D.C., and that's all the criminal justice agencies and youth agencies and family-serving agencies, and think about crime as a problem that exists in a city that's about the city and about the people there, and it's not specific to specific actors or specific places or specific kinds of people. It's a phenomenon that exists, and you need to think about it holistically if you're going to do anything about it. So if you're thinking about juvenile justice, you have to think about the schools, you have to think about families, peers. It's not just about, you know, the facility that you take the worst kid to and lock them up for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we try and do is we try and do a couple of different things. So we think about what's going on in the research community at large. We think about what other people have learned other places and other times about what's been effective for solving particular problems. And we try and figure out what it would cost to do those things in the District of Columbia and what the expected benefits would be to the citizens of D.C. if we did those things here, and try and make recommendation to the mayor's office and to all the partner agencies about what we think we could do here to actually have there be less crime for less money. More public safety with less of an investment.
We started off with when I was starting off the program, I said most states fly by the seat of their pants. When I was the director of public information for the Maryland Department of Public Safety, I was in with the Secretary of Public Safety when the governor of the state of Maryland called and said, you know what, I saw this ABC special in boot camps. Mm-hmm. I really like this thing. We should do this.
Right.
And that the decision to do boot camps in the state of Maryland was made instantaneously in terms of a 30-second phone call between the governor and the Secretary of Public Safety. That's how most criminal justice decisions are made in most states and most cities throughout this country. That's a guess on my part. Is it a reasonable guess?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I mean, I don't think there's much of a research base in most public agencies, whether they're state level or municipal. They don't have the capacity to do their own research, and in many instances, they're really not interested in doing their own research. But you know, the problem that you just highlighted about boot camps is sort of the classic example that for every difficult problem, there's a solution that is simple, intuitive, and wrong.
Right.
And it's the thing that is apparently easiest to sell to your constituents are there are two kinds of things, and neither of them work. One are these very simple solutions, things like Scared Straight. Let's bring some kids into prison and show them how bad prison life is. Let's do DARE. Let's bring a police officer into the schools and show them how dangerous drugs are. Boot camps. Let's get kids up at dawn and make them do push-ups. None of that stuff works because none of it addresses the underlying reasons why kids become involved in crime. And then you have, on the other end, you have deep, deep end solutions like, you know, mandatory minimums, three strikes, truth in sentencing, long prison sentences that lead to mass incarceration, that lead to tremendous strains on state and local governments' budgets, that miss the entire point of incarceration, which is there's a huge body of research that says people make decisions about whether they're going to commit crime or not depending on whether they think they'll get caught. The size of the penalty doesn't matter. Am I going to get 6 months, a year, 2 years, 10 years? That doesn't make any difference in my decision making. I just want to know if I'm going to get caught. So huge investments in mass incarceration, long prison sentences, that doesn't work either. And there's lots of stuff in the middle that does work, but people have to be open to the research to hear it.
You're funded by the Office of Justice Programs, U.S. Department of Justice. It's one of the it's where the city gets the money to contract with the Urban Institute to do these things. You know, there's an awful lot of things that are intuitive. There's an awful lot of things that people from that very gut level feel that could work, should work. DARE is one example. I mean, you know, you have DARE is where you have the police officers in the schools. You're teaching them drug education. And we've said over and over again that the research indicates that that these programs do not work, and yet they're very popular. DARE programs, there's a lot of people who say, I don't care what the research has to say. I like it. There's a lot of people out there who say, I don't care what the research has to say. I believe a person should serve 20, 30 years in prison for a very serious crime. How do you overcome that?
Well, I think let me talk about DARE because it's such a classic example of what goes wrong in the system, and then we talk about what we should do to overcome that. So with respect to DARE, so what DARE does is depends on where you are, whether it's fifth or sixth or seventh or eighth graders. Your police officer comes in, he's got his suitcase full of drugs, he opens up the drugs and he says, you know, this is cocaine, this is heroin, this is crack, this is marijuana, these are the instruments you use to smoke these, to ingest these, to inhale them, to do whatever with them. And what you are in effect doing is demystifying drugs for young people who've probably never been exposed to them before. So it takes some of the fear out of it and makes it just a little less costly for them to start using because they've got some information. They're not as afraid. Now, places that like this model will say, well, okay, so it doesn't reduce drug use, but it does have a couple of benefits. One of the benefits is it reduces it improves the legitimacy. It improves how students, how school kids see police officers because they see a police officer in a non-confrontational setting. And that makes them just a little more open to what the police officers say to them on the streets. And the opposite happens where the police officers get to talk to somebody who isn't in trouble with the law, who's normal. And that makes them a little better at their job. But it's solving a problem that it doesn't intend to solve. And there might be better ways to do that.
We have a question for today's show. Very interesting coming from Robert Pierre, an editor at the Washington Post. He asked me the other day via email the percentage of D.C. of the D.C. population behind bars. And throughout my, you know, 17 and a half years in the District of Columbia, first for 10 years with the two national organizations and 14 years in Maryland, back for 7.5 years, I've constantly seen this reference to 60% of the population has spent time behind bars. Certainly over 50% of the population has spent time in prison. Is there a valid basis for that observation? I've never seen the methodology behind those observations. I've never seen somebody come along and say, this is what we base that estimate on. So how can you prove it or disprove it?
I mean, the way you'd have to answer that question is you'd have to get data from the Department of Corrections in D.C., which is the D.C. jail, and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. If you are sentenced on a felony in the District of Columbia, you go into the federal system. If you get a misdemeanor, you go into the local system. So you need to go to a federal database and a local database. You need to pull, you know, decades worth of data, and you need to figure out, how many people went in once and how many people went in over and over and over again. The way right. people do this, try and answer this question, is they say, well, there were 50,000 arrests in D.C., and over a 10-year period, that means half of all D.C. citizens must have been arrested. And it's just – it's not – correct. Right. That's just wrong. You need to. People get arrested over and over again. I did a study of the Philadelphia prison system a few years back and found that 80% of the people who spent time in the Philadelphia jail were there more than once.
Right.
And so that means a very small percentage of the population gets into jail.
There's a lot of turnover. Right. And now, in my response to Robert Pierre, I mentioned that there's a lot of turnover within the system.
Yes. So you have these people that they're referred to as frequent flyers,
yes.
cyclers, whatever you want to call them. Now, there is a real issue in the District of Columbia. The Pew Charitable Foundation released a report last year that said that 1 in 31 Americans was somehow on any given day,
right.
which is kind of a different question, but
right.
on any given day was somehow involved in the criminal justice system, be it that they were incarcerated or they were under some kind of supervision,
right.
either post-release from prison or awaiting a trial.
Right. And BJS has put out the same figure. It's the Bureau of Justice Statistics.
Right. And in some places, they find that the number that for African-American men between 20 and 34, those numbers are as small as 1 in 6, 1 in 7, 1 in 8.
Right.
So clearly in a city like D.C., you have a lot of young men are going to be involved in the criminal justice system on any given day, and that's an mm-hmm. important story. Sort of making up a number to try and, you know, make it seem like a bigger problem than it is, I don't think that's the way to get this into the debate, into the public discourse about trying to do something about this issue.
The whole idea is to bust myths in terms of using criminology, using criminological data, using hard data to come up with good, clear solutions instead of, again, flying by the seat of your pants.
Right.
In terms of dealing with something that gets you some coverage, mm-hmm. it certainly gets you some attention if you come out and say, quote a statistic that grabs people by the intellectual throat. But there are better ways of doing it, and that's hard, cold, clear research, and that's what you're advocating.
Right. And I think, so I can give you a bunch of different examples of this and why this is important. I heard an ad on the radio last night, and I can't remember the name it's an alarm company that responds to burglaries, and I can't remember their name, which is good. I don't want to give them any publicity. But mm-hmm. but the ad starts with this sort of ominous message from the announcer saying the economy is terrible and crime continues to increase, and thus we should, you know, you should get our product. Well, the reality is that crime has been going down since 1991. It's been going down for two decades, and the crime decline has actually accelerated the last couple of years.
Almost continuously, and that's amazing.
Continuously. And we are at crime levels now that we haven't seen since Richard Nixon is
right.
president. I mean,
since the 1970s.
Right. Or mid to late 60s. So if you are 40 years old today, you are probably safer today than you have ever been in your life. And I don't think that message is getting out. And I think it has one particular consequence, which is really too bad. So if it bleeds, it leads on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And every time crime is really volatile, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see a rash of burglaries in one place and then nothing. You'll see a deadly weekend where there are three, four homicides and then nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And people only hear about these little mini crime waves in their neighborhood or their part of the city or in the city as a whole, and they use it to conclude that everything is, you know, it's just really
spiraling out of control. Let's put up the bars, let's put up the alarms, and for the love of heavens, let's run for the suburbs.
And let's pay to have people incarcerated for 30 years when we don't need to.
Okay. Well, the whole idea is to get over those myths. I mean,
right.
in the District of Columbia, it is like the national crime scene. Crime has gone down, certainly not by the national levels or the same amount as the national levels, but crime has steadily decreased in the District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. Violent crime has steadily decreased mm-hmm. in the District of Columbia. But if you watch the evening news, if you read the paper, it doesn't apply to D.C., it applies to any city
right.
in the United States, you're going to get the impression that crime is going up. When I tell my wife the crime is almost continuously going down for the last 20 years, she looks at me like as if I have three heads.
Right.
If you go and do a public forum, and if you say the crime is almost continuously down for the last 20 years, again, you have gasps.
Right.
It's just
right.
inconceivable to imagine. If you watch the network, and it's amazing, A&E has it, the History Channel has has it. Lots of these big cable channels have these shows, Hard Time or other sort of Gangland or other sort of shows. If you your exposure to the media tells you that you are in danger, and I want these people put in prison for the longest possible period of time. Right. I mean, that's and you can't blame people for feeling that way.
So I did an interview last month with The Guardian, which is, you know, a distinguished paper in England, and going through all the reasons, explanations for why crime has declined. And there's actually 15 or 20 different things that you could talk about that explain some of the crime decline. Mm-hmm. And we sort of walked through all of these things. And then this article got a ton of response, hundreds, if not thousands of comments. And the overwhelming majority of them were, oh, I don't believe this. They don't know what they're talking about. Crime's going up. So if you can't understand the nature of a problem, you cannot solve it.
John Roman, senior fellow of the Urban Institute. They've been around, ladies and gentlemen, since 1968 as being one of the most respected institutions look at urban problems, study urban problems, study crime problems. They've been around since 1968. John is also the executive director of the D.C. Crime Policy Institute. What we're trying to do is to look at the application of crime research to cities and states, not just in the District of Columbia, but throughout the United States, and to try to find the lessons learned. All right, John. So
let me, if I might, I want to just correct something you said.
Please.
So in at the peak of the crack epidemic in the late 80s and early 90s, when crime, violent crime in particular, peaked in the United States.
Yes,
there were a little more than 24,000 homicides.
Right.
Last year, there were less than 15,000.
Right.
So that's a pretty substantial drop. Not quite 50%.
Right.
In the District of Columbia, at the height of the crack epidemic, there were more than 400 homicides, almost 500 homicides.
Right.
This year, D.C. is on track to record about 108.
That's amazing.
So that's a decline of 75% or more.
That's
which is actually
unbelievable.
Twice as much as we've
decline.
Seen
unbelievable
nationally.
Decline.
So there's a lot of good things have happened in this city.
You know, I remember the city being back early, or when I was working for the National Crime Prevention Council and the National Criminal Justice Reference Service, and I remember we're going back 30 years now, and you were afraid. I mean, I'm a former state trooper in Maryland, newly minted with a master's degree, and coming down and working for these organizations and being afraid to walk the streets. Mm-hmm. D.C. has changed. A lot of cities have changed. You have cities like New York where you can touch it, feel it, smell it. But if you go into Baltimore, Cleveland, lots of cities throughout the United States, and if you say that crime is going down nationally and crime, in fact, is going down in your particular city, which it has in Baltimore, the people are just going to look at you as if you have 25 heads.
Right. And so it's really interesting. If you look at the top, I have something coming out next week at www.urban.org, where we look at the top.
Oh, I have not mentioned the website, www.urban.org, www.urban.org. It's one of the reasons I write these things down. So I'll repeat that. I'll have it in the show notes, and I'll repeat it a couple times throughout the course of the program. Go ahead, John.
So Urban Institute has a blog, and I have a post coming out next week where we look at the top 25 cities in the United States and compare their peak homicide rates to the homicide rate in 2000 to the homicide rate in 2010, and it declines in all 25 cities, and it declines pretty uniformly. There are some exceptional success stories. Washington, D.C., New York City, as you mentioned, and Dallas are exceptional success stories. But otherwise, you see this incredibly consistent trend across cities in the United States. You see a couple of cities, like Milwaukee, for one, where crime has gone back up since 2000. But overwhelmingly, the crime decline is a national story. Some cities have been even more successful than the average city in the United States. But crime is down everywhere, and it's down substantially.
And it's interesting that there are many in the criminological community who will suggest that crime is an international story, the decline, that it's also going down in Great Britain. It's also going down in New Zealand. It's also going down in Australia. It's also going down in Germany, that we have not just a phenomenon for the United States. We have a phenomenon for the Western industrialized world.
And it's a wonderful insight. And it calls into question a lot of the explanations that we have in the United States, because we only look at the United States for why crime declined, and we miss these stories. So, for instance, the mass incarceration phenomenon is a U.S. U.S. phenomenon. Mm-hmm. As other nations you mentioned haven't experienced it, and yet they see similar kinds of crime decline that we've seen here. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of changes in how police that occur internationally. And so that makes you say, wow, well, the policing story has more credibility to me than the prison story. Maybe all of this incarceration hasn't bought us that much, because in other industrialized nations, they've gotten the same crime decline mm-hmm. without this incredible. I mean, we have four times as many people in prison today as we did 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the effect on state budgets is just astronomical. And here we are in the midst of this great recession, the financial collapse. State budgets are under tremendous pressure. The federal government budget's under tremendous pressure, likely to make the state situation even worse. And yet we aren't talking very much at all about state spending on corrections, which makes up an enormous percentage of state budgets in most places.
Well, the states, virtually every state in the United States is complaining bitterly about the amount of money that it puts into corrections. Mm-hmm. And states throughout the United States are struggling. I mean, it's been the dominant topic within the media and crime and justice for the last 2 years, the fact that the states are saying we can no longer afford the level of incarceration. Now, I'm not going to get into a debate as to, you know, is that good or bad from a criminological point of view. It's simply saying that the states are saying that they can no longer afford it. So we, within the criminal justice system, need to come up with something to guide them. And I think Urban and Pew and the Department of Justice and the National Institute of Corrections are doing just that.
Right. And I think, you know, we have learned a lot in the last 3 decades from a research perspective about what works.
Let's talk about some of that, because we've been talking, we're two-thirds the way through the program, and we haven't talked about what does work yet. We've talked about what the problems.
Right. And I think, you know, and there's a lot of good, and there's a lot of good things happening in the District of Columbia is a great example of things that work. You have a police chief here, Kathy Lanier, who is very open to research. She reads the research. She can talk knowledgeably about some pretty obscure pieces that are very important about mm-hmm. how you figure out who's most risky and who the police need to target their scarce mm-hmm. resources mm-hmm. to. I think policing changes in policing have been effective, more professional policing, more problem-oriented policing, more proactive policing. Mm-hmm. Hopefully in the next generation we'll get into a more forensically oriented police force.
You mean somehow, some way, we live up to all the nonsense that people see on television every night?
60-second digression.
We could go on for the next 5 years about that. That's my pet peeve, but go ahead, please.
Well, nothing you see on CSI is true.
Really?
Nothing you see on
CSI. That's shocking.
Yeah, I know it's shocking.
That's shocking.
So it tends to take months for a piece of evidence to get through from beginning to end. But the most important takeaway is, in this country, almost no suspects are identified via forensic evidence. We use forensic evidence in this country
to back up the arrests we've already made.
Yes. So anyway, coming back, so what else works? So we know a lot about alternatives to incarceration program. Okay. It's taken us decades to learn something that should be patently obvious, which is that if you are somebody who has a substantial problem that causes you not to be able to contribute to society, you have a mental health problem, you have a substance abuse problem, you have family problems, whatever these things are that cause you to commit crimes in support of these problems, that if you address the underlying problem, in many cases, you can keep people from committing crime.
You're four times more likely to be caught up in the criminal justice system if you have a mental health issue. I'm not saying that everybody with a mental health issue has contact with the criminal justice system, but the odds, the pure stats, is that they are four times more likely to become involved. So why is it, when I take a look at the stats, the overwhelming majority of the stats say that the overwhelming majority of the people caught up in the criminal justice system do not get the mental health treatment, do not get the substance abuse treatment? There's a dichotomy.
Right. So the problem is, you know, the story's a little better on the mental health side, because correctional systems have a responsibility by law to provide medication to people who have been diagnosed with a mental health disorder. Now, there's a lot more that need to be done for those folks other than just to medicate them. The drug story is far worse. We provide almost no treatment to people while they're incarcerated, which is a real missed opportunity. If I get you for 2 years and can give you residential treatment, your chances of getting out and doing better are just vastly improved.
Right.
The problem is that it would take a big upfront investment. We did a study a couple years ago, and we looked at what the upfront investment would be to treat everybody going into the correctional system for their drug abuse problem rather than incarcerate them, and estimated it would cost U.S. $10 or $15 billion to create the infrastructure to do that. Mm-hmm. The returns, though, would be $40 or $50 billion in terms of crime rates going down even further from where they are, from not needing to use criminal justice resources to investigate, arrest, and incarcerate folks because they don't need it because they're not committing crimes because they're not using. And then you have all these other benefits, like our correctional systems are places where HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, hep C, all these really chronic, horribly expensive conditions where the rates of are just, you know, 3, 5, 10 times the rates that you see in the population. The correctional systems have to spend money to care for those folks, and then they come out and they have to use public health resources. And keeping people out of prison, stopping them from sharing needles and getting hep C and HIV, all of these things are far more cost effective than just, you know, mass incarceration and just housing people.
www.urban.org, www.urban.org. All right. So it's basically, we know what to do in law enforcement. We know what we should be doing in terms of treatment of people caught up in the criminal justice system. We know that we can probably provide alternatives that may be more cost effective and may protect public safety better in the long run in terms of depending upon the risk of the offender. So those are three things that you've mentioned right there that are lessons learned that can be applied to D.C., can be applied to Milwaukee, can be applied to any place. What else?
I mean, there's a laundry list of things we can do. We have people who leave prison and they've been inside prison for, you know, a year, 2 years or more, and they're completely unprepared. They come out, they don't have any identification, so it's impossible for them. You know, it's how do you even get into a government building to meet your probation officer, right? Much less go and get a job. They come out without any medication, so they were being treated for their mental health problem, and they come out and 48 hours later they're in crisis because they didn't have a prescription with them the day they left.
Okay,
they don't have a place to stay.
But let me take you in a different direction in terms of the limited time we have left. Okay, so we have to have programs for offenders, and they've been proven to be cost-effective through a variety of things. We know that we have to be more aggressive in terms of law enforcement and working with the community and the way that you apply law enforcement to places and people, specifically targeting, rather than mass efforts are more effective. Drug courts. Let's go over to the judiciary.
Sure. Okay, so drug courts, again, this is a place where I think this is part of the explanation for why D.C. has been more successful than average. And you see this in New York as well, where they've really here they have the Superior Court Drug Intervention Program, which is a program that I evaluated back in 1999 and found that it was effective in preventing recidivism. And it's been going on here for 12 years. And the basic idea is that you take drug-involved arrestees, and instead of incarcerating them for their crimes, you put them through this 12 to 18-month program where they get intensive judicial supervision, intensive treatment supervised by a judge and a case manager, where they work through their relapse such that if they actually relapse, they don't just go back to prison like you would under most parole arrangements or probation arrangements.
They are supervised by us. That's my commercial. Court services and offender supervision agency and pretrial services. Yes, go ahead.
And the idea is, you know, people who are in recovery relapse, and you need to get people through relapse to get them into long-term recovery. And the data suggests that not just in D.C., but around the country, we just finished the National Drug Court Evaluation at the Urban Institute last month.
Yes.
And, you know, the story is that it's pretty effective. It reduces recidivism 10 or 15%. It's not a magic bullet. It's not going to, you know, reduce it by half or something. Nothing will. But if you do all of these things together, you can really reduce crime in a major way.
I'm going to stop you right there and ask you the final question before we close the show. The average person out there says to themselves, I can't keep up with all this. I get stuff from Urban. I get stuff from the different criminological institutes. I get stuff from BJS. I get stuff from the FBI. I get stuff from the National Institute of Corrections. I get stuff from the National Institute of Justice. I get stuff from the Office of Justice Programs. I can't deal with all of this. How can I simplify it, and how can I find out these lessons learned?
I actually think, you know, there are actually some public media outlets. Look, Gangland and Lock Up and all those shows, you know, infuriate me as much as they do anybody else, because if you watch Gangland, you're looking at 1990 footage, so that's annoying. But there are actually shows like PBS Frontline that do a terrific job, and they've covered many of these issues over the years, and they do podcasts, and NPR does wonderful podcasts.
But the average police chief is not going to be listening to Frontline.
So
the average schmuck out there in a criminal justice system, how do they keep abreast of all this research?
Well, I would say, though, that you could go to NPR or Frontline. I did a study that found that if you collected forensic evidence and you used it to aid a burglary investigation, you could you could tenfold increase the likelihood that you get an arrest. I went to the International Association of Chiefs of Police meeting, 17,000 police chiefs, and we had maybe 100 in the room. And you have to start by being open to what the research says, and then it's easy to go out and find places that can tell you what's important.
Are we doing the best job that we can do within the criminological community to distill it down to its barest bones and to apply lessons learned?
No, I mean, I think there's a lot of work that can be done, but there are a lot more groups like Pew and Urban that are trying to be more translators than just, you know, evidence creators.
And I think it's obvious in terms of the publications you put out and the publications Pew puts out, and the Office of Justice Programs is making that transition as we speak, trying to make it simpler, because the big complaint is I'm overwhelmed by the data.
Right. I mean, National Institute of Justice has National Institute Journal. Nancy Ritter is the writer there. She does a terrific job. That's a wonderful resource. Probably a great place to start.
John, you've been a blast to have on the program. John Roman, Senior Fellow of the Urban Institute, www.urban.org, www.urban.org. He is the Executive Director of the D.C. Crime Policy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, this is D.C. Public Safety. We do appreciate your calls. We do appreciate your emails. We appreciate your criticisms. We appreciate your compliments. And we appreciate your suggestions in terms of future show topics. And please, please have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.